Hey everybody, this is Patrick Milliken, and I am here with J. Todd Scott, who is in town to discuss his new book, This Side of Night. Terrific book. Thanks for talking to me.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And you just came back from Thriller Fest.
That is correct. I actually never been to Thriller Fest, and it kept getting suggested to me that I should go. So I went. I'm actually going to VoucherCon later this year.
Cool.
Trying to hit them both. And, you know, it was really a treat. And, you know, obviously going to the panels, I got to be on a panel and then go to some. But really the best part of it was meeting other authors who I had heard of and knew or maybe had, you know, exchanged Twitter things with. But to get to meet all these writers that I admire was fantastic.
Any special?
Yeah, I got to talk to David Swensen. Who's fantastic.
Great writer.
I think his latest is Trigger.
Yep.
A great book. Peter Blauner, who I was a fan of, had not met personally, had the opportunity to talk with him. Riley Sager, who actually he and I had been on a panel together at the Tucson Festival of Books, and this was just after Final Girls.
Right.
And obviously, you know, his latest one, I think it was, is number 9 on the New York Times bestseller list. So he must be living right and doing something right. So to spend about 45 minutes with him talking about, you know, the books he's writing and things he's doing was great. And you know, just the other authors that I was on panels with, like D.P. Lyle, I met J.T. Ellison, you know, writers that I had admired and read, and the opportunity to sit and pick their brains made the entire weekend, you know, worth it.
Right. Well, this third book that you've written, I think it's your best so far. I think it's just a knockout. And it was inspired in some cases, or in some ways, by a real incident that happened.
Right.
Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, and I have to, you know, go on the record and say I'm not the only author lately to use that incident.
Yeah, Don Winslow.
Don Winslow did in his The Border. And it's the 2014 student massacre in Iguala. And, you know, 43 students disappeared. You know, even now the facts are still very controversial.
Mm.
You know, some claim it's a government cover-up. Some say it was corrupt cops. Maybe it was cartels mistaking these students for other, you know, narco traffickers. You know, the only thing that anyone can agree upon is it was a tragedy, and the parents of those students still have a lot of unanswered questions. So, you know, there's been a lot of fantastic reporting about the incident, and I referenced some of that in the acknowledgments to the book. And my take on it doesn't attempt to answer any of those questions, and all I wanted to do was to remind people that these things happen. It's not fantasy, it's not fiction,
right.
You know. And I wanted to use it as an opportunity for the first time in the series to take the book south of the border.
Mm.
I'd written about the border, had not really gone south before. And I introduce a couple of characters, some survivors of, you know, this attack, my version of it, who decide that there's relative safety in Murphy, Texas. Now, they may or may not be right about that, but that's what they decide. And that gave me an opportunity to write about that incident a little bit and then follow these two young characters as they make their way northward.
And then, you know, America Reynosa, who's now Chris Cherry's deputy,
right?
And she's kind of the thread that kind of ties all these books together in a way, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I've kind of said it in other contexts that she's kind of the center of gravity for all the books. You know, Chris Cherry, I think, is the face in the shadow that we always see on the cover of the books. You know, but the reality is it's more her story, I think, than anyone else's, and that comes to fruition here in the third book, where the seeds in the far empty that were planted kind of about her family south of the border, her relationship with the narco trafficker Fox Uno, all that was kind of hinted at, and I bring that arc kind of to a conclusion in this third book when she has to make some decisions about the family that she was born into and then the family that she has chosen, which is Chris and Mel and the other, you know, and the deputies there at the Big Bend Sheriff's Department.
Now, you know, writing about the border, of course, right now, it's highly politicized.
Yes.
Highly polarized. A lot of misinformation about what's going on.
Right.
You know, you're writing at it from, in some ways, a unique vantage point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you work in the DEA and you're very of course, up to the minute on what's going on. What do you agree that there's just there are a lot of people that are coming at it from a completely misinformed perspective?
Well, I think that the border is more than a slogan. It's more than a line in the sand. It's more than a river. It's hard to encapsulate in a 140-character tweet.
Yep.
At the end of the day, what I have seen working in the region, conducting drug investigations in the region, is that you're really talking about, you know, families and communities and cultures. And that's hard to make a meme out of. That's hard to make an Instagram photo out of. So it's far more complex than you can tweet about. And, you know, I try in these books to give all the characters, good, bad, whatever, this sense of, you know, that they are from this place and that this place has some unique qualities that you're not going to find anywhere else.
And you give them a sense of humanity.
Yeah, I think most people don't see themselves as villains, and I think what's fascinating is choice, and I've said this actually for every book. Every choice is kind of a beginning and an ending, and most people, in hindsight, could look at their choices and say, man, that was really stupid.
Right.
But we don't have the benefit of hindsight, so most people are making the best choices in the moment that they can,
right,
and justifying to themselves why they're doing it. And I don't like characters who are all white hats and perfect and always make the best decision. And I don't like villains who always make the worst decision, because I don't really think that's how people, really are in real life. And, you know, I've done a lot of undercover and listened to a lot of wiretaps. And, you know, even the narco traffickers that I've dealt with, the outlaw motorcycle gangs, the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas guys that in High White Sun, you know, they're not all bad all the time.
Right.
Right. And you know, you hear them talk to their kids or their friends or their mothers. And you know, there's lives and collateral damage beyond, the immediate arrest that I make, you know, in my job.
Every Sicario, you know, has a family and kids and
right, yeah,
you know, someone to go home to.
Right. And everyone I've ever arrested, and it's been a lot, unfortunately. You know, they're someone's brother, mother, you know, brother, father, sister, mother, whatever.
Right.
And generally, you don't arrest the whole family. And so I've walked guys in handcuffs out of homes, leaving behind spouses and kids. And, you know, I think that's the part of my job that people don't see, and that's the part of these border questions that people don't see, is that you're talking about communities and families, and the two are intertwined.
You know, it's funny, you met some of the kind of the walk-on characters I find really interesting, especially in the new book, and I'm sorry that the gentleman's name escapes me, the guy, the kind of the tweaker that lives out.
Yeah, Eddie Rabbit.
Yeah, what a great character. And he's, you know, he's just what you say, you know, he's somebody who's made some wrong choices.
Right.
And is kind of caught in this particular moment.
Yeah, and Eddie's interesting because, you know, I don't write with an outline, I don't plot, I kind of know the beginning and I think I know where I'm the end, but I really oftentimes don't know how I'm going to get there, so I just kind of fumble my way through it. And Eddie was, you know, I had him in the opening sequence where she plays such a huge role with him and Danny, and I really thought that he would kind of be written out of the book after the first couple of chapters. But as what happens when you write the way I write, sometimes you just kind of get interested in a character, and I found him fun to write about and interesting to write about, and he gave me a viewpoint that no other character did. And since I write so many of my books with multiple viewpoints, he provided kind of a lens that no one else had. And so although I thought for sure he was off stage in the first couple of chapters, I kept coming back to him and back to him and back to him, and he ends up shouldering a huge chunk of the plot later in the book. It has a very significant role, and I never would have predicted that if I had just plotted this book, you know, or done an outline.
And I'm sure you've met a lot of Eddie Rabbits.
Oh no, I have. Right, I have. And people who are victims of circumstance, and who aren't necessarily bad or evil people, but again, they're victims of their choices.
Right.
And you know, Eddie kind of has a chance to redeem himself in some respects. And you also see in the relationship that he has with Danny and some of the other characters, is although Eddie's a criminal and has done bad things, his relationship with the police in that area is not entirely antagonistic.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's not this white hat, black hat, we always have to be at each other. They can respect and understand where each other is in their lives and the roles that they have to play. So anyway, I left Eddie in there. I kept writing about him and writing about him. And one of the first notes I got back after my editor at Putnam read it, Sarah, the first thing she said was, "I love Eddie Rabbit. I'm so glad that you left him in there and that he, you know, did what he did in the books." And she goes, "He's one of my favorite characters."
Yeah,
in
I agree.
The whole book.
Really loved him. Well, and Danny Ford is really interesting too. You know, here we were talking just the other day with another writer about, you know, who uses veterans, you know, in their books. And yeah, he's got a heavy load on his shoulders too.
Yeah, and I, you know, I've not been in the military. I haven't served overseas in that capacity. But obviously, I know a lot of people who have. There's a lot of agents who have been in the military prior to coming on the job. So I've had those conversations with them, and I don't want to pretend that I can portray that in the way that someone who's actually lived it can. But I thought it was important to recognize that violence that you know our armed forces deal with, the violence that cops and agents deal with, that we see, that we're sometimes subjected to, that has a cost. It has a price. And you know, Danny is kind of my take on this, on the traditional, you know, kind of more, I don't want to say Jack Reacher-ish sort of character, but you know, he's got skills that Chris doesn't have and that other people doesn't have. But he's also haunted by the things that he's done and the things that he can do. And so I wanted to, again, portray someone who had been through these experiences and they had not left him unchanged. And then they affect his choices going forward.
And you have, you know, this whole generation, or almost two generations now, of veterans coming back from this, you know, interminable war.
Right.
And, you know, going into law enforcement, going into all different areas.
Right. And what's interesting about Danny is I had used him in High White Sun a lot to talk about the difficulties in doing undercover, in being and playing another role,
right,
and how you get up close and personal with people. And again, you realize that people aren't all evil all the time. Most aren't. And the struggle that Danny had with that. And so him kind of struggling a little bit with you know, PTSD and the things that he had done, you know, overseas, that kind of all played into that in this book.
Now, I know, you know, from talking with you before, you know, we're both big big fans of Cormac McCarthy.
Yes.
And, you know, in the first book, the character, the judge,
Stanford Ross,
who kind of his influence continues throughout all these books very strongly. Did you find that, you know, with Cormac McCarthy in particular and other writers, the landscape kind of lends itself to a style of writing, if you will?
I think so. I mean, I've said it before. I think probably you and I have talked about it. You know, I see place as character, and I actually think most people, not to mention, you know, fictional characters, but most people are a product of where they're from, the families that they are born into, the areas that they live in. And I think that's particularly true if you're from a small, kind of a remote town. You know, you can't escape the shadow of the family, you know, the legacy that you have. So I find that as a writer fascinating. I've seen it play out as an agent in the small towns, both in Texas and Kentucky, where I'm from. I've seen that play out again and again and again. And so someone like Stanford Ross, who's a product of that environment and you know, been invested in this huge amount of authority, you know, could he have turned out any other way than he did?
Right.
In a violent, difficult place? And that's the question that Chris asks himself all the time. If you actually look at the two books prior to this, you know, Chris has mentors. I'm not saying they're good cops, but they're mentors. One is Stanford Ross, who kind of shows him one way to carry a badge and gun. The other is Ben Harper, who shows him another way to carry a badge and gun. And by the third book, by This Side of Night, it's up to Chris to decide how to carry a badge and gun. Right? Can I protect the people that I care about? Can I enforce the law? And can I do it in a way where I maintain, you know, my sense of self, my sense of dignity, and the values that I that I hold. I've seen how these other guys do it, right? Good, bad, or indifferent. I've seen how they've done it. And now, how can I do it? And that's why Chris, to me, is such a fascinating character, because throughout three books, we're watching him figure out how to do this job.
And also in that area, you know, the connection to kind of the Mythic West is much more of a, I don't know how to, you know, it seems closer.
Oh, yeah, no, and I have said before, you know, I love Westerns.
Yeah.
And I love all the tropes and the themes that come out in these stories. And, you know, I'm thrilled that my books are considered modern Westerns, because that's, you know, that's what I write around. And in a Western, you know, you have these men who have been kind of formed and shaped by the rugged terrain that they have to work and survive in. And you know, I've been criticized a little bit because there isn't a mountain range or cloud or dust thing that I don't write about. But, you know, I like that. And I think there's something, I like the juxtaposition of the lyricism of the land and the beauty of it juxtaposed to the violence that occurs there. And no one does that better maybe than Cormac McCarthy. You know, James Carlos Blake has done that very well, right? But I love that juxtaposition.
You know, let's put in a plug for James Carlos Blake, shall we? I mean,
absolutely.
About a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, we hosted an event with James Carlos Blake, who's, you know, we're both huge fans of his work. Talk about a writer who's never really gotten his due.
Well, it's interesting because...
Critical acclaim, definitely.
Critical acclaim, right. Like when I was, you know, younger and reading stuff, you know, his books... to me were giants, right? I mean, they were literary masterpieces.
Yeah.
And I thought that everyone loved his stuff as much as I did. And, you know, as you go on, you realize that's not true. He got a tremendous amount of critical acclaim, and I'm not sure he ever got quite the commercial sales that maybe he was due. But, you know, he was doing this sort of stuff long before I was, and he was doing it much better than me. And he's still putting out great books now, you know, his Wolf series and everything that he's doing. And, you know, when you see fantastic authors like Don Winslow and others who are writing in this vein and doing so well, you can't help but ask yourself and want to point people to someone like James Carlos Blake.
Right.
And say, if you like what Don's doing or if you like what I'm doing, then you got to go read what he's doing, what he did before and the stuff he's doing now. Because... you know, in some respects, we're all just palely imitating the work that he's done.
He's brilliant, and it was fun because, you know, you came out for his appearance here, and another really, really, I think, fine writer, Neil Griffin,
right?
Drove all the way over from San Diego, you know, to meet this master who everybody idolizes so much.
Right, and he sat and gave us the time and
we
talked
had a nice little dinner with him.
Yeah, we had a nice dinner, and you know what was interesting? I don't know if you even knew this, but maybe a year later, 6 months later, you know, High White Sun was recognized down in Tucson at the Library Association there as a book, and they brought me in to do a talk. And the association reached out to James Carlos Blake, and he wrote an introduction for me at that event and talked about my book and my stuff. No, I didn't know this. No one told me. I had no idea.
He
didn't come out to the event. He, you know, gave a script that they read. Because, you know, he doesn't like to get out too much.
No.
And he wrote a beautiful kind of introduction about me and my books that they somehow got him to do. And it's one of the greatest things that's happened to me in my literary things, to have a guy that I idolized whose books were on all my shelves, and to have him say such nice things about my stuff was great.
Wow. So everybody, after you buy Todd's new book,
right,
go out and buy some James Carlos Blake.
Absolutely.
Well, I understand that with your next book, and then we'll sign off here, but with your next book, you're kind of switching landscape a bit.
Yeah, a little bit. I'm from Kentucky, and I'd always wanted to write a book set in Kentucky. And I'd actually worked there with DEA for 4 or 5 years, and at the kind of beginning of the opioid crisis, when we were still dealing with pill mills and stuff at that time. Have worked a lot more in that area since then, but
pre-fentanyl.
Pre-fentanyl. Yeah, this was all just straight up OxyContin and things like that.
Good old fashioned.
Good old fashioned, right? Yeah, the guys with shotguns outside of pain clinics. So I wanted to kind of address that and write a book, from that area. And so I had this idea. It was a little bit different than kind of what I've done in the Big Bend. Sarah at Putnam, loved it. And so that's what comes out next year. It's called Lost River, and it's a crime novel. If you like the characters and the sort of things that I'm doing in these books, all that will be there. But it's set basically over a 12-hour period in a small town in eastern Kentucky, and it's set against the backdrop of the opioid crisis. Kind of one long hot summer night, all these events kind of all transpire, I'm pretty happy with it. I'm going through the first pass pages now, it's set to go, and it should be out August of 2020.
Fantastic. Well, hey, Todd, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I
really appreciate it.
It.
Awesome.